Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, of the making of books, there is no end. How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Now, with me in the studio today is my producer, Mr. Dan Arnfeld. Good afternoon, Dan.
Hello.
So, I was going to tell you this morning, as I was getting ready for this, that I don't have any comments. And then I noticed I got a little message from Facebook. You know, I have the program, I have the podcast on Facebook, and they said, your comment section is getting pretty full. Do you think you ought to, like, maybe reduce it? And I'm thinking, what are they talking about? So, for all of you people that have been commenting on Facebook, I want to apologize, because I forgot all about that section. And now there's like probably a good 50, 60 comments on there. So forgive me, all of you out there. But there is one that I thought I'd bring up. And this is from, I'm almost embarrassed to give his name because it's so old. But he says, my only complaint is the program is only 30 minutes. And so I know I've read a few other ones, and I think from time to time, if I don't get a fresh one, I'll use some of the older ones. But for all of you out there that have been writing, forgive me for being so snooty over this stuff. But anyway, keep those comments coming in. Now, for the gentleman that said that the program is only 30 minutes, we do have an hour program. It's all about Shakespeare. And it's called Shakespeare's Royal Education. And so you can have a full hour of that all that you want. And anyway, it's good to have the two programs. Now, on our last program, I finished chapter 5, titled Send Her Victorious, of part 2, Into Africa. And this is, of course, this is Candace Millard's book. And then I also began to discuss chapter 6, and the title of that chapter was We Have Now Gone Far Enough. Now, again, we did have a good discussion on it. I'm going to go back and maybe just re-highlight a few things to keep you up to speed. Now, for today's podcast, what I want to do is I want to finish chapter 6. Now, this is, we can't do it in one podcast, but I'd like to get further into it than we did by the last program. So by way of review, remember now, chapter 5, Candace Millard did a great job. She gives us insight into the British view of the coming Boer War. And as Winston Churchill even said, they were pretty blasé about the whole war. They weren't really all that excited of it, about it. And in some ways, the more I thought about this morning, I think author Candace Millard, when she titled that chapter, Send Her Victorious, that was the British sentiment, is they were sending the ship full of soldiers and all that, but they wanted them to be victorious. They really wanted to win, you know, the whole shebang. And then to signify the British view of their success in war, now this is the title of chapter 6 is Candace Millard. She gives us the Boer's view of the British and how to wage war. And so you know, chapter 6, the title of that one is We Have Now Gone Far Enough. And essentially, I think what she's saying is they were really prepared for this conflict, and they've gone far enough. They're just waiting for the British to show up. And, you know, it really is interesting. The British thought the fight was going to be over really quickly, but the Boers were really well prepared for the coming fight. And it's really interesting. The more we get into chapter 6, the more I got into it, it's really pretty, their history, the Boer history is really fascinating. And it's really, she gives a really good view of their history. And if the British had really read about their history or really understood it, I would think they'd have taken a lot more measures than they did, because these guys are amazing, the Boers. And so we're going to get into that. And what I want to do today is I want to start on page 69. And at the very very first two paragraphs there. And I know we had gotten through some of this, but I just want to go back through it just a little bit and remind you of how maybe I should say that Miss Millard gives us some really chilling insight of the war mentality of the Boers. They really were warriors. And then she gives this great history. And I didn't necessarily wanted to talk about the history, but the more I read about it this morning, I thought, oh, no, this is what you really need. So just remember, this is just a little bit of a repeat from last time. But the thing is, we want to understand clearly is that the Boers were definitely determined to win. They were determined to win this war. They weren't going to be just giving it up. We'll read about that in just a minute. We're at the top of page 69, the first paragraph. It says, whether they were hunting lions, which raided their herds of cattle and flocks of sheep and posed a threat to their families, or fighting the native Africans whose land they now occupied, their lives depended every day on the speed and accuracy of their shooting. So these guys were great marksmen. And I think I've even heard at the Olympics this year, I'm not sure, but I think a South African won one of the rifle contests in there. Now, I could be wrong about that, but I wouldn't be surprised. It says they were the finest mass of rifle-armed horsemen ever seen, Churchill wrote, and the most capable mounted warriors since the Mongols. So once Churchill got there and he was observing what was going on with the war, he began to realize, man, these are some tough guys. These are really, they're really great rifle-armed horsemen, and they're warriors. They're capable, even like the Mongols were. Now, this is the paragraph. The second one down is where this phrase comes in. They were also determined to win. They felt that they had no other choice. Although Southern Africa had been populated for millions of years before the Boers arrived, they believed that this land was their birthright, no less than a gift from God. They were certain that if they lost, the resulting tragedy would not only devastate them, it would, in Kruger's words, stagger humanity. And so there was a lot of, I think there was a lot of people in the world at this time that were focused on South Africa, and they had a lot of support. The Boers had a lot of support to keep control of what they had gained. And so there was the world looking in on this. Now, as we go down to the next paragraph down right in the middle of the page, here's some more of the history that I think I read some of this before, but it won't hurt to read it over again. It says, as the burghers filed past Jobert that day, and remember now, Piet Jobert was there, and he's the man who led the Boers against the British 20 years earlier. And there's a lot of people had already come into the Transvaal area. They're filled up the city of Pretoria. They were all ready for the war. So it says there, as the burghers filed past Jobert that day, brandishing their Mausers in a self-styled salute, one man stood out among the long gray beards and rough, heavily lined faces of the members of the Volksraad. Now, the Volksrad, again, now that is the Boer language, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that if we have time today. If not, we'll do it the next time. But the Volksrad is essentially the legislative assembly of the South African Republic. In other words, this is like their parliament. This is like their, like we'd have our Congress. And but it's called the Volksrad. It says, and the Transvaal Parliament. Lois Botha, now this is what she wants us to focus on. Lois Botha, nearly 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered and sinewy with dark hair, a closely trimmed goatee, and violet blue eyes, looked as though he could have been carved out of the heavy clay soil of Natal, where he had been born. Although he was only 37 years old, among people who revered age, he was already a respected member of the Volksrad, or this legislative assembly. He had a position he was about to abandon so that he could go to war. And so he was going to give up his position just to go to war. So it can show how dedicated they were. But she goes on to write, no man in the crowd that surrounded him was more thoroughly Boer than Lois Botha. And the story of his ancestry was the story of the Boer creation. He could trace his family back to some of the earliest days of the European settlement in South Africa, to the hundreds of Huguenots who left France for South Africa in 1685, after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which had made their religion and any but Catholicism illegal. And so here you had the Huguenots. They were kicked out of France by the Catholic Church, but they moved to South Africa. It says, on one of the ships sailing out of France was a man named Botes, or it might have been Botes, and that's Bottes, or perhaps Bodes. No one knows with any certainty, because he changed his name to Botha soon after reaching the Cape of Good Hope. So infuriated were the Huguenots at being cast out of France that when they arrived in Africa, they refused to speak the French language, a ban that extended even to their own names. Botha and his fellow Huguenots quickly joined forces with the Dutch, and together they seized control of the region. Spreading from Table Bay to the foot of Table Mountain, they raised cattle, sheep, and grew everything from grain to wine grapes in the fertile soil. Armed with guns and horses, neither of which the Cape's inhabitants, the San and the Khoikhoi peoples, had ever before seen, and bringing with them devastating European diseases, they quickly decimated the native population. So they brought in their diseases, and also, you know, their willingness to take the land and keep it for themselves. So in some ways, the Huguenots, the Dutch, and they weren't necessarily very kind to the local people as well. It says, by the time the British began making their own claims on the Cape at the end of the century, the Dutch and the Huguenots, along with an infusion of German immigrants, had already transformed themselves from rogue splinter groups into an entirely new ethnic group, neither European nor African, but Boer. In their manner of life, their habits, even in their character, a journalist for the Times would write, they had undergone a profound change. The Boers even developed their own language. And so you think about it, you've got Germans, you've got Dutch, you've got the French, and they decided to make their own language, which is called Afrikaans, which mixes Dutch with everything from French and Portuguese. And then again, there's a native tribe. It's Khoikhoi. The word Boer itself, which means farmer, is Dutch, but the Boers quickly developed new words as they needed them, from Kopje, which means hill, and Veld, which means grassland, to Voortrekker. And so here they changed their whole culture, they changed everything. Early in the 19th century, soon after the British had made the Cape of Good Hope a permanent possession of the empire, two new generations of Bothas, and one is called Philip Rudolph Botha, and his two young sons joined the Great Trek. And I'll explain to you now what the Great Trek was. As they struck out from Cape Colony in an attempt to escape British rule, their slow rolling processions of covered wagons pulled by long serried lines of oxen were almost indistinguishable from the westward movement that was taking place at the same time in North America. So as they were moving west, Americans were moving west as well. So it's really pretty interesting. In fact, the American pioneers, the Boer Voortrekkers, crossed part of a vast continent that was not only unknown to the outside world, but inhabited by large groups of a native people whom they would spend decades in brutal compact. Instead of the Cherokee and the Iroquois, however, the Boers faced the Zulu, one of the greatest warrior races in the world. And if I can do this right, I had to look this up on how to pronounce it. And you have to do a click first. So it's Xhosa. Instead of trying to say the ex-Xhosa, it's Xhosa. And so the tribe into which Nelson Mandela would one day be born. So this is Mandela's tribe. I think it's really kind of interesting history if you really think about it. While the Voortrekkers settled in pockets of grassland scattered around an enormous sweeping desert known to the Boers as the Great Karoo, the Bothas skirted their eastern coast, passing from the desert into the veld and winding their way toward the Republic of Natalia. It was here, about halfway between the port town of Durban and Peter Munzenberg, roughly 50 miles ahead, that Philip Rudolph Botha and his sons finally stopped, establishing a farm and helping to build a railroad station in a town that would become known as Botha's Hill. It did not take the Bothas long to lose any trace or even memory of the Frenchmen they had been only a few generations before, although the Natal had already fallen into British hands by the time of Louis. Philip Rudolph's grandson was born in 1862. The family continued to lead a solitary, fiercely independent way of life that was stubbornly Boer. They had no interest in any land beyond Africa, no tolerance for any man or institution meddling in their lives, no allegiance to any flag other than the thick, colorful stripes of the two remaining Boer republics, the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. Although technically a British citizen by birth, Louis Botha had the most traditional of Boer childhoods. He grew up in a family of 13 children on an isolated farm in Greytown, about 100 miles from Durban, and between a German mission school and a traveling tutor, had received only a couple of years of formal education. He was, however, fluent in several languages, including Zulu, Sotho, both of which he knew better than English. He also learned how to shoot a rifle as soon as he was strong enough to hold one. Like most Boers, Botha's family had spent the great majority of their lives at war in one form or another. So these were warriors. They were at war all the time. And so how could the British be so naive to say, this is going to be easy. It's going to be an easy thing. And it turned out it was not. So he said, as a child, his mother had hidden with her grandmother, the two of them frantically making bullets. Can you believe that? The women are making bullets. While her family desperately tried to repel a Zulu attack, Botha's father often clashing with the nearby Zulu who, while fighting the Boer incursion onto their land, had on several occasions burned down their farmhouse. Louis himself had fought not only against the Zulu, but with them. In 1884, when he was just 22 years old, he had formed and led a group of Boers who, in exchange for vast swaths of land, had helped the Dinzulu, crown prince of Zulu nation, defeat his rival for the throne after his father's death. So can you believe this? They made peace with the Zulus, and they fought wars for the Zulus. So you're talking about people that know how to fight. And so to me, I think Miss Millard really captures some history that you just wonder if, you know, did Winston Churchill know this history? Did all the soldiers and leaders of the British army, did they know all this? Let me just go on. It says, in fact, Botha had nearly been killed during that war, not by Dinzulu's rival, but by his own men. After a long day riding by himself through Dinzulu's territory, setting up landmarks for the other men, Botha had come upon an abandoned shanty where he decided to sleep. In the middle of the night, he was awakened by the sound of chanting. Peering through a window onto the moon-drenched veld, he saw to his horror that he was surrounded by Zulu, all armed with assegai, that's their spears, or throwing spears, and chanting in unison, "We have come to kill the white man." How would you like to wake up to that one? "We have come to kill the white man." Leaning out the window, Botha shouted in Zulu, "Who are you?" "We are the warriors of Dinzulu," came the reply. "But I have been fighting on your side," Botha shouted back. The chanting immediately ceased, and the men lowered their weapons. As Botha walked out of the shanty and stood in the moonlight before the men who moments earlier had been about to slaughter him, he was hailed as a friend and a fellow warrior. So there's a guy with a lot of courage. Perhaps because of his long experience in battle, Botha did not like the idea of killing other men. When tensions with the British had begun to rise, he had hoped that war could be averted. He had even been among the handful of men in the Volksrad who had voted against sending the ultimatum to England. Finally, however, he had come to the conclusion that if his people wanted peace, they must first have war. "The Transvaal has done all it can in order to preserve peace," Botha had said in a somber speech to the Volksrad, "but I think we have now gone far enough." So that's the title of the chapter. On October 12th, the day after the deadline for the ultimatum, the Boers burst southeastward out of Pretoria like the breaking of a dam, rushing toward Natal, the British colony on the Indian Ocean, coast that had once been theirs. It was raining in heavy sheets, and a fierce freezing wind was blowing off the mountains, but the men, most of whom had neither tents nor overcoats, took little notice. As far as the eye could see, the plain was alive with horsemen, guns, and cattle, all steadily going forward to the frontier. Dennis Reitz would recall the years later, when he was no longer a boy. The scene was a stirring one, and I shall never forget riding to war with that great host. So the next day, the Boers crossed into Natal, and with suddenness that would leave the British military reeling, the war began. And so they really were geared up for this war. And, it's very, very interesting. And it goes on there, it says, Botha was among the first wave of horses and men surging out of the capital, breaking away with a small group to capture the first British prisoners of war. Six frontier policemen who were so shocked and unprepared they were able to put up no resistance, he rejoined his commando, a Boer combat unit, just beyond the Buffalo River. By the time they merged with other commandos, they were 8,000 men strong. Can you believe that? 8,000 men strong. And all sweeping eastward with an irresistible force toward the little coal mining town of Dundee, where the commanding British general, Sir William Penn Simmons, had set up his camp at the base of Tallana Hill. And so the British are now waking up to reality that they've got 8,000 men they got to deal with. And so, that's really, really shocking. Okay, so in Natal, Penn Simmons and his counterpart, General George White, remember George White, he said, "I don't think there's going to be much going on here." Anyway, so now here's George White, were equally unconcerned about the tens of thousands of burghers surrounding them from nearly every direction, and had decided to divide their already woefully inadequate force. Of the roughly 12,000 men, some 8,000 had gone northward to the British garrison town of Ladysmith, with White and the other 4,000 farther north with Penn Simmons to Dundee. Both towns were beyond the curving Tugela River, which Buller had repeatedly warned them not to cross until he arrived. By the time he reached Ladysmith, White, taking in the stark terrain and the tension that seethed in every town he passed, had quickly realized that he had made a serious mistake. "Goodbye, dear old lady," he had written miserably to his wife. "We should have 20,000 more troops in South Africa than we have." Penn Simmons, however, continued to insist there was no cause for concern and confidently marched his small brigade even further north than Ladysmith to Dundee, where he planned to set up camp. In Dundee, Penn Simmons ran his brigade much as he had in India. He hosted guest nights in the regimental mess so that his officers might bring their wives, encouraged his men to wear their scarlet and green dress uniforms, and cheerfully discussed plans for Christmas dinner in Pretoria. Even as his scouts warned him that the Boers had begun to descend upon Dundee, Penn Simmons scoffed no Boer commander would dare to attack a British brigade, no matter its size. "I feel perfectly safe," he coolly told the agitated officers under his command. "I am dead against retreating." So this is interesting. And we're coming down to the very end of the time I have for today. So hopefully this has whet your appetite to do some more reading on your own. And then we'll be talking here in just a minute about what we're going to cover next time. So that's all the time I have for today's program. Now, on our next program, we will continue to discuss Candard Millard's book, Hero of the Empire, Part 2, Into Africa, Chapter 6. Now, as I said last time, I promise you, we will finally stand on the battlefield with the British and the Boers and our hero, Winston Churchill. Now, you can buy a new or used copy of Candace Millard's book at Amazon.com. You may be able to find a good copy in your local bookstore, or, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature, and if you comment on Facebook, I'll be checking for them. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.